Please note, this episode contains descriptions of violence in the home, domestic violence, child abuse, forced sex work, branding, suicide, and complex compound trauma. Listener discretion is advised. I am thrilled to introduce you to Rebecca Bender. Rebecca makes a massive difference in this world, and we'll talk about that more later, but it's important to give a context to the difference she's making today, to share her story and how she got to the place where she's making the difference she is today. Rebecca, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
It is truly a joy. So will you share with us what it was like before it all went wrong?
Yeah, my childhood was kind of a normal, all-American, small-town kid. I was born and raised in Southern Oregon. I grew up skipping rocks at the river, taking a salt shaker out to the garden and picking a tomato. I was an only child, and so I played a lot outdoors. I made a lot of forts, and I was really loved by my family. I was the first grandbaby. I was just adored by my grandma, and all the aunties doted on me, and so a lot of love. When I was 9, my parents divorced. My dad had worked at the local lumber mill, just blue-collar family. My mom taught aerobics on the side, and so when they divorced, it was a really ugly divorce. It was very volatile. My dad started drinking for his own emotional, getaway. And then my mom was now suddenly a single mom after being a stay-at-home mom, trying to make ends meet, working a couple jobs. And so between 9 and about 13, life was really hard and really different. I still would have never been put in an at-risk youth category. I still was an honor roll student. I was a varsity athlete. I just can remember little things behind the scenes that maybe weren't normal. Getting picked up by my dad and him driving right to the bar and me sitting in the car for a couple hours while he went in. And I remember walking to a payphone and calling 1-800-COLLECT. That kind of dates me. But to tell my mom to come get me that dad hadn't come out of the bar for a while. So just some vulnerabilities that took root in my heart, I think, during that real transformative year. I mean, 9 to 13 is still a pretty forming years, and I had moments of feeling really alone and really unwanted and really unimportant while my parents tried to pick up their pieces of their own lives at only 30 years old. I mean, they were young, so I don't blame them now as a woman who's almost 40, but back then as a young kid, you just don't understand. And you become a little desensitized to violence in the home. Dad's throwing things against the wall, yelling. Mom is now dating. And finally, by the time I got into high school, she remarried an incredible stepdad that I have today. It's been in my life ever since. And things became back to normal for us. And I still was a little bit of a latchkey kid because my mom worked a full-time job and I'd have to walk myself to and from practice, but really like little tiny things. These aren't big, wasn't in foster care. I wasn't sexually abused growing up. I had for most intents and purposes, a fairly normal, quote unquote, normal childhood, but still lots of vulnerabilities behind the scenes that maybe people didn't know about that really played a role in how I made decisions as a young adult.
Got it. So often when we hear stories of survivors, we start to look for predictors.
Right.
And I'm talking about savvy people start to look for predictors. And initially, I think, I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but I think initially we've got this view on the topic that it's sort of like a made for TV movie. It's obvious, it's seedy, it's suspect. Anyone would see it coming a mile away when in reality, it's far more subtle. It's far less easy to identify. And there are the predictive factors aren't as cut and dried as you're saying. It was a fairly normal upbringing. There were a few things underneath perhaps, but thank you. Please go on.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. It's such a misperception of what human trafficking in America looks like. People envision, you know, stranger danger, kidnapped kids. You know, I'm an 80s kid. I grew up being taught stranger danger, look for the guy with a puppy and a candy, you know, and the problem that happens with that is, you know, different predatory behavior is determined by crime, right? And human trafficking, that's a different type of crime. They have to create a product that is sellable over and over and over without having to re-up their supply. To them, this is a business. And so when you can put on, from like a legal perspective, which is what I work a lot with now in a legal capacity, when you can put on that lens of, if this is a business to the criminal, how do you make your product sellable? And so that predatory behavior of how to get their product becomes very different than a stranger danger scenario. And I think the culture that we're all raised in has painted this one type of potential trafficking based on movies or, like you said, you know, screenplay scenarios. The problem with that is that as a victim of human trafficking, I grew up in the same culture as all of you. So I too pictured all the things that you're picturing, you know? And when my situation isn't playing out like that, I'm thinking, well, I must not be being trafficked. My boyfriend loves me. And maybe this, maybe that. And we miss self-identify for a long, long time. I actually didn't identify as a trafficking victim probably 2 years out of my human trafficking experience. I thought for a long time that word was reserved for only kidnapped kids overseas and that I was forced into prostitution, but I wasn't trafficked. And that's the lie that I believed to cope, and because of the misinformation that's out there. And I think the more we can sound the alarm and do things like this and raise awareness of what really does it look like, the more we actually can see it in our own communities, and the more victims will start to say, well, that happened to me. And you're like, yeah, that's why we want to help you get help, you know?
Right. So you've got this fairly normal upbringing, and you're a teenager. And then at what point would you share with us the chronology of events at that point?
Yeah. So I ended up graduating from high school a year early, 17. Now, you know, I was still a party girl in high school. I was still the gregarious, vivacious. I found a lot of community in being the yes girl, being the party girl. I'd play a, you know, soccer tournament and be the goalie. And then at a basketball season, I'd be a cheerleader. And then I'd jump in the back of a 4-wheel pickup truck and head to the bonfire and ask an adult at Circle K for some beer. Like I prided myself on people wanting to like me. And I think that's from feeling so alone growing up that I just wanted to be a part. And so I was willing to compromise boundaries even here and there. So it wasn't like I was just this, you know, I don't want to paint an incorrect picture. I still was the yes girl. I still was a varsity athlete and honor roll student. I was accepted into Oregon State University at 17, graduated a year early. So by no means, I was still ambitious, but I had a lot of boundaries that had already been, you know, kind of pushed as a young person to feel apart, to feel like people wanted me there and I wanted to belong. I went off to go to college. Like I said, I was accepted into Oregon State. And then that summer I got pregnant by my boyfriend and I decided to unenroll from the university and keep my daughter and go to community college. And I'm so glad I did. She's an amazing young woman today. But she's also kind of what kept me fighting for our lives because she was with me during my entire time of human trafficking. And it's also kind of what the traffickers used as a threat. Couple times that he had taken her, said, you won't get her back until you obey the rules. And so, you know, it's hard because there's a lot at stake. There's a lot as a young mom, not knowing what to do, not knowing how to navigate the trauma and the fear. And am I going to get in trouble by the cops? Is my kid going to be taken from me if I reach out for help? There's all these things and lies that the traffickers tell you that you start to believe because you don't really know how to navigate some of these systems. So here I was. I ended up during my time going to community college, my friends who had moved out of the dorm room and into an apartment on campus invited me to move in. And I thought, finally, I'm going to get out of my small town and go up and become like a college kid. The tables are going to turn for me. But those same vulnerabilities of being alone and unwanted and unimportant resurfaced on campus when I, you know, kind of became the girl on campus with the kid. And that's not really popular 20 years ago. There wasn't a lot of opportunities that universities made for people like they do today. And so it was at that time that I met that time of having those same vulnerabilities of feeling alone and not really knowing how I was going to navigate. My aunt had started stripping. She'd become a dancer. So I was really desensitized to kind of like, you just go and dance and make some extra money. And one of my roommates had started. So there was all these other desensitization and normalization of really this commercial sex industry that I didn't realize until, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, how much cultural influences really play a role in your decision making and lens of life. But it was at that time, during all of this kind of going on, that I met the most incredible guy. He was funny and he had all the answers and he had all these great big ideas of how I could do life, even though I was a single mom, that I didn't have to live in poverty. He really sold me this idea that life could get better. And it's something I think I was really hungry to hear.
Right.
Being a single mom, trying to put myself through school, watching people around me, he sold me what I wanted. Yes. But that's what predators do. They identify your vulnerability and that's what they exploit. And they're good. They know what to look for and they're chameleons. They change with every potential victim to offer the very vulnerability that that one's hungry for. And so he dated me for 6 months. I thought he was my boyfriend. I had fallen head over heels in love. Is now a 19-year-old girl. So by the time I turned 18, I moved up to campus. And by the time I turned 19, I was dating him. And then he told me one day that his job was relocating him to Las Vegas. And I asked to go. He said, families don't live in Vegas. And I thought, he thinks we're a family. It's the first time that he had really said it out of his mouth. And I like to bring that up because people picture, again, these kidnapping scenes. They picture the movie Taken with a girl gripping at the carpet by pulling one leg, you know. And that's a very different dynamic when you think about the victim asking to go. And that's the whole point of the definition of human trafficking is the use of force, fraud, or coercion at point of recruitment and destination in order to profit off of the commercial exploitation of another human being. That's the legal definition. And so sometimes I think we only envision the force and we're not thinking about the fraud or the coercion that starts at the beginning of the relationship or the threats when you finally arrive at your destination. There's all of these kind of complex nuances that until you hear people share their story, which is why I'm glad you're doing this, then people can start seeing like, oh, wow, that was fraud at point of recruitment. Oh, wow, that was coercive threats at point of destination. And yet there still had not been any physical violence up until that point. So it's really much more complex in terms of like the psychological mental chains that began getting put on people. And traffickers know what they're doing. They got to keep their product sellable. It's a business, right? We got to kind of keep remembering that. Otherwise, we blame the victim. Why didn't she run? Yes. Why didn't she do this? Why didn't we
know better? All of that. And it's when you say that, it's so essential, Rebecca, for those of you listening to understand these predators know human psychology. And not that they've studied it, but yet they have. They have
some
studied
might,
precisely what makes a person those subtleties between feeling culpable and part of it and wanting the thing that they're offering and then feeling guilty or at fault for having gone and instigated or at fault for it having occurred in the first place. And all those subtleties serve to be the handcuffs that keeps a person there. It's a very nuanced, mutually participatory event. Thank you so much for shining a light on that, Rebecca. This is something people don't usually talk about. Okay, continue.
Well, and traffickers, I mean, you're right on, because traffickers there's an actual article out called How to Use Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs to Traffic Women that a trafficker wrote and published. There's been multiple books on Amazon that traffickers publish on how to traffic women. I mean, those aren't always the exact titles that they choose. Some Amazon has removed as soon as someone marks it and flags it. But there's also forums where traffickers get on and talk to one another and share information and share, you know, ways to manipulate, ways to brainwash. It's a very much a psychological game, and they know that, and they're learning from one another. It's similar with the demand, right? The men that are buying people. It's a similar, there's forums for buyers. They call themselves prolific hobbyists. Mm. There's erotic review places where they can rate women in human trafficking, young women in trafficking, just like you could rate a restaurant. Be careful for the catch and release. That girl shows up 50 pounds heavier than she advertises. Not nearly as young as her picture would make you believe. Give her a 1-star. All these things. People don't even realize this is on the open web. This isn't on the dark web. And it creates these groups of people that then think that their cultural norms and their set of standards is normal because they're interacting with one another, just like any gang mentality or groupthink mentality. And the thing that I think is important to point out is at the end of the day, every one of the players in this triangle of exploitation, the buyer, the seller, the victim, every one of them were a young person who probably never thought this is what they'd grow up to do and engage in. And so for me, this whole mission is really for me about cultural change. Like, what are we doing in a really hypersexual culture for our young men growing up in foster care, our 6-year-old little boys that are being put in front of porn as their babysitters? Like, this is about the victims, yes, but at some point also, like, how do we really fix some of these roots? It's not just rescuing the one. It's about these systemic roots of hypersexuality, and how can we pull that thread back in all of these areas? For me, that's what I'm really passionate about.
It's so important, and because your perspective is different than anybody else's. You know, as the survivor, you bring a view that nobody else can hold. Thank you for sharing your story. So there you are. You moved to Las Vegas as part of this, quote, family. And then what happens?
The day that we arrived, my quote unquote boyfriend, who I now, you know, I'm thinking is my boyfriend. He says, leave the baby with my brother, who I had met lots. I mean, this is a natural progression of what you would think is a healthy relationship. You meet their family. So there was not a ton of red flags. I mean, there was some now that you, a hindsight as a healthy adult, you can look back and see lots of red flags. But in that moment, as a young person, I just thought, yeah, I've met his brother lots. It's part of being in a relationship. And he helped us move. And so he was going to take me out on the town and show me Las Vegas. And so I put on my best club gear, borrowed my friend's fake ID. I always joke, this is pre-Jesus, don't judge. And so I'm up in the club, you know, I'm thinking this is going to be living my best life. I'm from a small town. Vegas lights are invigorating. He had taken me there on vacation once before, and we had just club hopped the whole time. So I'm assuming that's what my night is going to be like again. Again, these are little things that traffickers do on purpose. It's that analogy, you drop a frog in boiling water, it jumps right out. If you put a frog in cold water and turn the stove on, it gradually cooks to death. It's that. It's these little subtle steps that takes a good 6 months to build that false sense of trust, right? And so here we are. I got dressed up and we left the baby with his brother, and he drove me to a dead-end street. And I can remember we looped the car around this dead-end street up along the curb. And on the right-hand side, there was this deserted strip mall. There's no lights, no signs. I think it was on like Harmon and right off Harmon and Tropicana. And right behind the Wild Wild West. People know Vegas. They know exactly where I'm talking about. And so maybe it was Billy Dean. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's right in that area and right close to the strip. And he parks the car and he says, I spent a lot of money to get you here. I put first and last on the apartment. I filled the fridge with food. That was money that I was using for my job. And I thought, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize. I felt a little bit embarrassed that I didn't know how much it cost to move halfway across the country. And I felt like I was the young, naive girl. You know, he was, I thought 24, found out that that's not his real age either. But, you know, so you're thinking a little bit older boy, I'm embarrassed. I didn't know. And he said, well, do you see that door with the camera over it? That's an escort service. And I'm going to need you to go in and sign up. And I said, escort sounds like prostitution. No way. And he said, no, it's just like dancing. It's just like being in the club. You've been in the club. You know, people you know have been in the club. This is how it works in Vegas. I'm in the entertainment industry. This is how you send dancers to those fancy suites where you see all the girls that are just like in their bathing suits at pools in the fancy suite. This is how it works. And I thought, oh, I mean, he's smarter than me. He knows entertainment, maybe. But still, I pushed back again. I said, escort sounds like prostitution. I'm not that naive. I'm a smart girl from a small town, but I'm not that naive. And that's when he slapped me across the face. And he said, you're going to go in this room and you're going to get my money back. And I can remember in that moment feeling all the things that any 19-year-old girl who's being hit by someone she loves for the first time would feel.
Yeah.
And then I remember thinking, I don't know where my baby is. I just got here yesterday. I didn't write the address down. I didn't like text it to my mom. We probably didn't have texting back then as much. There was a little, but not like it was. I didn't give it to anyone. Like, it just was this sudden realization that I just needed to get through the night and get home. Was just kind of what, like, I'm just gonna trust that I can believe him and get home to my baby. And so I complied out of fear, out of you know, really wanting to believe him, really wanting to believe the person that you love. Even though there was lots of red flags and now I'm really afraid, but I don't know where my daughter is. Like, I'm just going to get home. I'm just going to do what he needs me to do until I can get home. And maybe it will just be dancing. And so when I walked in the room in this escort service, there was three women, their desks are all butted up together in the middle. And there's a dry erase board on the wall that says blonde, brunette, redhead, Asian, exotic. And all these names underneath, like Bambi, Candy, Ivy, you know, all that, what we, and so I'm thinking, okay, it's kind of like a strip club. Like, there's people on deck, quote unquote. And the lady has me fill out these forms, takes a photocopy of my ID, wants to make sure I'm over 18. And you're kind of reading the fine print, but you're like, just like any medical form. You're not really thinking, but you're just kind of pretending. And she says, it just states that you won't solicit. We don't hire those kinds of girls. And I went, see, I can trust him. See, okay. It's good. Yeah. Oh, it's dancing names. She's making me sign a form. Like, okay. And so at every little stop, it felt like I was able to push my conscience aside and lean into trying to kind of find the areas to justify believe him until it clearly wasn't. And that night I was sold for the first time. And I can remember just freezing and then getting back in his car and feeling like, man, I've crossed a line that I know that shouldn't be crossed. And I've taken money. And he said, I remember getting in the car and him saying, how much did we make? Everything was we. How much did we make?
Wow.
I said, I think I got like 300. And so I pulled it out, like almost going to count it, and him taking it out of my hand and saying, you'll do better next time. You didn't have sex for this, right? And I just started crying. I thought, how did I get here? Like, I grew up from a good home and a good school. Like, it felt like every little tiny bit pushed until all of a sudden I'm falling off this waterfall. And I should have known, yes, but I'm looking for stranger danger. And all of these little things that made me think, well, now I have the moving money back. Maybe it'll stop tomorrow. And when I get home to my baby, and then the power and control wheel of domestic violence would kick in. Like, I'm so sorry. I love you. I'm not going to have us do that anymore. And you'd go through these honeymoon phases until there was a need again. And then it was a little bit more. And it just felt like you're on this hamster wheel that you don't know how to get off of. And now you're fully invested emotionally in this relationship. And it's really hard to be like, okay, so what do I do? Go back to being a single mom in poverty on campus now and tell all my family? And I'm so embarrassed of what he's made me do, and I'm scared. And he's getting physical. Now it is becoming domestic violence, and he is slapping me on a regular basis and pushing me against counters and taking my baby. And so now it is starting to become that forceful scene that we, I think, as a culture envision from the get-go. And that's not yes. it. It becomes really physical when you start saying no. If he can get you through with fraud, he'll lean on that all day long. So just, it felt like a very confusing tornado that I was living in and just didn't, it's like I just needed a minute to take a breath to figure out my next steps. And like a minute just never came.
Boy, that's how they control, keep you spinning. And it's interesting. I would imagine if anybody who hadn't gone through the logic of your journey and the progression of it would think, well, how could a mother do this? A child, there would be no ability, but it's the ultimate trap. Where is my child?
Right. And most people asking the very good, I mean, you know, sometimes people will say, why didn't you just run? Why didn't you ask for help? Why didn't you call the police? And I think, well, those questions is what has caused me to ask the same thing of myself. So I do appreciate them. But my answer is, why didn't I just run? I did. So I'm standing here today. I did run. Why didn't I run sooner? I had multiple attempted escapes. I would end up being trafficked for nearly 6 years. I was bought and sold between three different traffickers. I had two of them tattooed their names on my back like a piece of cattle so I could be returned. I've had my face broken in 5 places. I've been hospitalized for dehydration and overexhaustion. I've been to jail multiple times. Tried to commit suicide twice. Like I became very hopeless. And so when someone asks, why didn't you just run? I think, well, you're asking from a really healthy adult brain, but I wasn't in a place that had a really healthy adult brain at 19, experiencing a ton of trauma. Like we all didn't make great choices at 19. Even those of you who weren't trafficked still didn't make great choices at 19. And so by the time I'm 19, I'm now having lots of trauma. I'm having extreme abuse. I'm having people brand me. I'm having, complex compound trauma, multiple abusers by multiple incidents and multiple perpetrators. Like they're on that trauma spectrum. There's different types of trauma, and that polyvictimization, or what's also known as complex compound trauma, is when there's multiple perpetrators and multiple incidents. And so it's just a different kind of trauma. And my answer, you know, like I said, I did run, but I tried often. I got all the way home once and my trafficker showed up in my small town. I thought he was going to hurt my family. And I thought, just don't cause a scene. I won't tell anybody is what I remember saying. And there's been other times I ran all the way to the airport. And post 9/11, most people may not know this, but post 9/11, you can't buy a plane ticket with cash. And it's not like my trafficker left me his debit card. So I'm at the counter begging for them to sell me a ticket and they won't. So what do you do? Like, and there's all the trauma and the fear and here he comes and your phone's blowing up. And it's just like, you know what? I don't know how to navigate this new unknown world. And so I'm just going to go back to what's familiar until I can figure it out next time. And so it just feels like every attempt you get better for next time. And it just doesn't always play out like people think. So it's hard. It's a lot harder than I think people envision to try to run.
It's impossible from the way you speak about it. And it's so essential to give an actual human face to this, to the phenomenon, because it is those types of questions. Well, why did you? Why didn't you? How could this happen? And sometimes the people that listen are loved ones who are trying to make sense of it for themselves, asking questions such as, could I not have known? How could I not have seen it? Yeah. And I think in the process of trying to come to terms with our loved ones' experience, we inadvertently re-traumatize them. How could you think, how stupid, all of these things. I hear these things from survivors a lot. Anecdotally, I've experienced it myself, but in you sharing this, it starts to explain the phenomenon. It's not that you aren't intelligent. It's not that you aren't strong. There are multiple factors that nobody could possibly comprehend, not the least of which is at 19, your brain is still 6 to 7 years from completing its development.
Right.
You are still, in fact, a child.
Right. Yeah. And neurology... And neurology and trauma is fascinating. Like the more people learn about it, the more that trauma and the brain is so, it's just interesting. And so I appreciate the questions, but we have to remember that the person that's living in it is living through a very young developed brain that's experienced a lot of trauma. They call it Swiss cheese brain. There's parasymptomatic modes that we all go into, fight, flight, or freeze. It's way more complex, the nuances. And then you add on the stigma and the shame. And, you know, the third component that we hadn't even got to yet was that now there's other women in the home though. And other children. So now I have all these three, we call them wife-in-laws, that's the term. And so I have these three women that I've done life with now for years, and it feels hard to leave them. And I think, what am I going to do? Leave the little boy? And what's going to happen to him? But she's relying on me. And so you become almost like this little mini cult. And actually, research from the University of Northern Colorado has proven that domestic human trafficking now fits all 15 indicators of cult behavior. And so they're rewarding you for cooperation and they're punishing you for non-cooperation, which is a brainwash tactic. There's this set of rules and standards and ideologies you have to conform to give to the quote-unquote community, to the quote-unquote family. And so it becomes really this brainwashed cult that you're living in where you actually do form bonds with other women. And it's now not just the trauma bonding or the Stockholm syndrome of the trafficker and the captor, but now I have all these other friends that I can't leave behind. What am I going to do for her? Finally in 2006, the feds raided our home. It's how we eventually were able to escape. Actually it was a neighbor. So we're really big on see something, say something. Our neighbor thought something's wrong. They actually thought as our neighbor drug dealers is what she said. She had a friend who worked for law enforcement and talked to them, I think, at a Christmas party, from what I've understood the story. And she said, something's going on with my neighbors. There's four young women or three or four young women and one man, and I think they're drug dealers. That's what she said. And began this investigation. They quickly found out it was not.
Thank God for her.
Yeah, it was not drugs. It was actually a human trafficking ring that was both in Dallas, Texas, and in Las Vegas. She was the Dallas neighbor. And my trafficker ended up getting indicted on $4 million of tax evasion that he was laundering through a local pizza shop in Dallas that people just thought was a regular pizza shop. And it was owned by a trafficker. And that's how he was laundering his money. So that's what eventually was able to, charges were able to be filed. Feds had opened up an investigation on the crime family, quote unquote. And, you know, two women ended up going to prison. And this is why it's really hard. You know, the stuff that we teach cops today is when you're threatening that you're going to take my kids and put me in jail, and then you do that, you're actually solidifying my bond with the trafficker to know that he's the truth teller and you aren't going to help me. And so I grabbed my daughter and I was able to run. I got a failure to file charge, which is a big fine, but no prison time. And two of the other women were sentenced to 13 months in prison for tax evasion because my trafficker had put everything in their social to keep his own hands clean. And so two women left and did a year in prison. And so that was really hard because then in that moment, I could physically run, but now I've got this little boy that isn't mine. And what about my friend's legal fees and who's going to help her? And so it's just hard to figure out, like, how do you run from a cult with a whole bunch of trauma back to the same vulnerabilities that got you trafficked in the first place? Now I'm right back to being a single mom, trying to make ends meet, putting myself through school. But now I'm 26, a huge amount of trauma, PTSD, and a criminal record. That's even worse. So it's like, it's so hard, but it's possible. And we did it. And here we are today.
Man. And what a messed up system that put two women in prison.
Yeah, they have felonies now. I mean,
unbelievable.
The criminal record, you know, I mean, the barriers to reentry for people escaping human trafficking is way more complex than the general public realizes. You have horrible credit because your trafficker won't pay bills. They'll put everything in your name and not pay because they don't care about you. So you leave with horrible credit, huge debts to power companies and cable bills that you can't put on your own, or you don't have a cosigner. Huge amount of traffic victims have been in the foster care system. They don't have family that can co-sign for them. They're really trying to do it on their own. They're relying solely on the local resources of anti-trafficking groups in their towns to help get them to rebuild their lives. There's criminal records now. I mean, prostitution, it's hard to apply for jobs if that's going to come up. It's difficult. It's a lot more complex than just running.
Yes, it points to everything that's broken with the system.
Yeah, it really does. It
charges for prostitution. It charges for something you've done involuntarily. It's talk about adding insult to injury.
Well, so, and this is why we're big advocates for what's called the equality model, which will decriminalize the selling of sex to make people that are involved in sex work willingly, and those who are there by force, by choice or force. It doesn't criminalize them, but it will still hold accountable the buyers, the pimps, the panderers, the procurers, and the brothel owners that are exploiting women's bodies for profit. I think it's a big distinction between, it's a big push right now for full decriminalization. And I think that's a really scary social science experiment to allow pimps, procurers, panderers, and brothel owners completely no accountability. I'm not in favor of that as an advocate for women's rights and gender-based violence. We cannot just let all of these people who are profiting off of women's bodies not be held accountable. The equality model just focuses on the decriminalization of the selling. And so people can stay protected, stigmas can be broken. Those that are there by choice get to also have the same exit resources. So the equality model for us as advocates is what we're really pushing for. But I think the world doesn't know. They hear decrim and they don't know that there's like a full and a partial on the table. And so knowing about those differences and the equality model versus a full decriminalization model is a big deal because states are starting to pass laws. We have 7 that have it on the ballot this year and it's election season. We got to know what our local state representatives are voting.
Thank you for shining a light on that, Rebecca. So tell us about your work today and the ways in which you're making a difference in this world.
Yeah, thank you. It's so hard. The story, I know it's, we all want to hear, and then it always is like, but wait, we're doing stuff. Come join us. You know, as a survivor of human trafficking and exploitation, I didn't know what was going to happen to me when I was finally able to escape. I can remember just thinking, now what? This sucks too. Is this great life? Everyone talks about freedom, and I still felt very trapped. I felt, now I'm living in poverty. I'm on food stamps. I'm in government subsidized housing. I'm walking my kid to and from school because I don't even have a car. Like, it just was awful. And I remember having this moment where I thought, if I give my new life the same amount of time as I gave the bad one, it's got to get better. And I can't expect to undo in 30 days what took 6 years to build in me. And so I kind of decided that I was going to dig my heels in for 6 years and hope that it got better. I didn't want to give up too soon on the process. Yes. And so I started just sharing my story. I just wanted people to know that trafficking existed everywhere, even in small towns like Eugene, Oregon, which is the exact town that I was trafficked out of off the U of O campus, that this was happening everywhere. And that it looked really different based on the culture and the community in which you lived, right? What looked trafficking in Cambodia was going to look very different than Nigeria, than downtown New York City, than the suburbs of Denver, than the small town of Oregon. Like, it just looks really different. It doesn't mean that it's not happening. We just have to know what it looks like in our communities. And then we can really be equipped to make a difference. So we started by just doing trainings. And I decided to focus on law enforcement because I'd been to jail a lot. And I thought, well, I bet this federal case and all these state kind of county charges, maybe it would make a difference in helping with investigation. And so year to date, we've trained over 100,000 federal agents, FBI, CIA, Homeland Security, vice schools, special ops, prosecutors, judges, DAs. I've got to work a couple of cases where I've actually taken the stand at trials and testified as a human trafficking expert, just like a blood splatter expert or a forensic expert. And it's been really honoring to know that in the last 12 years of building this this company that we've been able to be a part of so many different lanes that it's allowed me to speak on the behalf of what we see that's more common, not just from my one lived experience, but the common tactics. And so also during that time, we started an online school because we had other survivors that were reaching out, wondering how they could be a part of making a difference, that they wanted their story to matter. They wanted all of this to not have been for nothing. And so I realized that there were survivors who lived in communities where services didn't exist. You know, those that lived in Little Rock, Arkansas, or Manassas, Massachusetts. And maybe they were just running home to a safe family or friend, but there wasn't a drop-in center. There wasn't classes. There wasn't trauma resources. And so the time I was finishing my degree online, and I thought, I'll just replicate what my university is doing and create an online school. And we did that about 6 years ago. And year to date, we've had 756 women go through our school in 8 different countries. And so from that and the law enforcement, we've really just tried to help give people the resources to know what trafficking really looks like, to find your lane in this fight. If you want to support a survivor trying to find her now what, we'll point you to do that too. But it's just all of us knowing that we all make a difference when we come together and do our part.
Well, I will post links to every way that anything you send us, all the ways that you're contributing, all the ways that we can get involved. And to that end, Rebecca, what would you recommend that each of us do to make a difference in this fight?
You know, I will do, this is a free but shameless plug. We offer a quiz. It's called Find Your Lane, and it's a funny, I tried to make the hard topic palatable. So it's kind of a fun personality quiz, just like we see everywhere nowadays. You take this short quiz and it actually tells you the type of human trafficking lane of advocacy, right? So there's prevention, restoration, intervention, policy reform, demand reduction, restoration, residential. There's all these different ways that we can fight. And so we wanted people to know there was 9 different ways that you can fight trafficking. And when you take this fun personality quiz, it tells you your highest result, but it also gives you details and resources for other nonprofits that are really finding their specific lane in this fight. And so it's free. We are asking nothing for it. We're not even pointing you back to us. We just really want to equip people because it's such a big issue. It's like, where do you begin? Well, just start here. Learn that there's 9 lanes, and then get plugged into people that are doing that work in the area that you kind of score highest in.
What an amazing resource, because I think one of the reasons it's overwhelming, obviously, is the subject matter. But I think the topic itself gets overwhelming because we don't know how to help, collectively speaking. What can I do? And this is just perfection. Thank you for giving us actionable steps that we can take to make a difference in this, each one of us. So, any final words you'd like to leave us with, Rebecca?
I'm just grateful that people are learning and interested. You know, people have been trying to fight human trafficking for a really long time. And every year it feels like more and more people are starting to listen. And so I'm just grateful. I'm grateful for every listener that's tuning in. I'm grateful that people are here wanting to even learn about a hard topic and willing to hear some tough things and sit in that discomfort in order to figure out how they can make a difference. And so I just want to say thank you to you for using your platform to share, and for every person that's tuning in and going to go out and take the quiz and just know where to kind of begin. I'm just really grateful. I'm really, really grateful.
And I am so grateful to you for being willing to share your story and your heart. You make a profound difference. Thank you.
Thanks.
If you or someone you know has been taken for sex trafficking, or you suspect that's happening, call 888-373-7888 or text the word HELP to 233-733. With your help, we can stop human trafficking now. To keep up with all of our latest work, please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Trafficked Series. Please be sure to rate, review, share, and subscribe to our podcast. and listen to our next episode with familial trafficking survivor, Vita Galore, who is on a mission to encourage victims to reclaim their power with an upcoming foundation called Free Her Forever. Until then, I am your host, Cheryl Hunter, and we are here to end human trafficking. So remember, if you see something, say something. This is a Conveyor Media production. Host and creator, Cheryl Hunter. Executive producers, Colin Whelan and Rebecca Sermons. Head producer, writer, and editor, Celine Beth Calderon.